and Terry Funk now comes for my heart. So take just a little bit of my heart, baby. You can have my soul, but you cannot have my silver-studded saddle today, Terry Funk.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 94 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson, and today will be a very different show for a variety of different reasons, because I'm going to be taking a look at the PWF, which does not stand for Pro Wrestling from Florida, although it might as well, because it is professional wrestling from Florida, but this is the Professional Wrestling Federation, so you can't accuse them of not saying exactly what they are. I mean, it is what it is. It formerly was known as Florida Championship Wrestling because the rights to the name Championship Wrestling from Florida was owned by somebody else. So that's just kind of a brief history on the name. But I'll be taking a look at the April 30th, 1989 edition. Well, sort of, because this show is also going to be very different in terms of how it sort of flows along. For you see, this is mostly about the then ongoing, and basically this was a forever kind of war. Kind of like the war on terrorism, but except this one was a lot more enjoyable because it involved Terry Funk versus Dusty Rhodes. The PWF is kind of the answer to the question of what was Dusty Rhodes doing when he got fired from Crockett, but before he turned up in the WWF? Well, it was this. And it's also the answer to the trivia question of, hey, what was Terry Funk up to as little as one day before the WrestleWar 89 pay-per-view? I'll get into all of that in just a little bit, but let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Like I said, I'd like to get enough emails to put together a mailbag show, although I'd probably have no problem just taking two questions and just talking about it at great length, as I might, you know, as I might tend to do. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. And you're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only and all you can find there a little bit later on. Now, also, the Place to Be podcast is coming out this Monday with a look at the Saturday Night's Main Event from November of 1988. I will be on that, as I am the very special NBC correspondent for covering the Saturday Night Main Events, which I really like doing. And now we're getting to the point where my dearly departed blog, where I reviewed all of the Saturday Night Main Events up to, I think I got to the Main Event 2, so the Mega Powers Explode. We're getting to the point now where I had stopped reviewing them, so now I can't lean on all those jokes. But my blog is now offline because, well, honestly, I did not feel like paying whatever it was because I was barely writing on it the last year and a half that I've been doing this podcast, and it was just kind of like a side promotional vehicle for all that, so it just kind of an unfortunate consequence. I'd rather spend the money on something like audio equipment for this, although I'll be getting that for Christmas, as I understand it. Or at least I hope, if I'm a good boy. I mean, I don't have an elf on a shelf, which, by the way, I find that whole concept to be preposterous and ridiculous until, remember, that it's for the children. If the kid likes it, it's the most important thing. I did get most of my Christmas shopping done over the last week or so. I do like going up to the mall just because, well, first of all, I live next door to a state, New Hampshire, that doesn't have a sales tax. So there, you kind of get the same benefits of the internet there. But I also like to just kind of experience the whole season, even though I immediately become annoyed by everyone around me, such as the slow walkers, the groups of three who like to take up your entire corridor of walking, so you literally have to walk to the other side of the mall to get around them. I don't like it one bit. But for all those annoyances, nothing quite bothers me as much as the Apple Store and the fact that that place exists. I absolutely hate that place so much. You walk in there, there's always like a trillion people. Yeah, they got a bunch of employees and they're very helpful, but like, seriously, you have all these products out and you're like, "Oh, we're not even going to list the price." And even when you pick up the device and it says $330 or whatever it costs, and they mention something about Beats headphones, it's like, well, clearly that's not included with this, because I know that this is also an overpriced item of some kind that made Dr. Dre $1 billion. So it's not like I can get both of these for one price. And you know what? I don't really feel like talking to you, Apple Store guy. As helpful as you might be, I don't like how many people are around. I don't like the setup of your store. I just don't like it, period. So I just walked out and left and made a vow to, if I need to buy any Apple products, I'd be doing it online. But I basically just kind of revamped the entire Christmas list of things that I had to get. One good thing that did happen this past weekend is I got together with two of my best friends. We had our second annual bourbon night, although the other one was technically also in 2018. I think it was the off week between the championship game and the Super Bowl at the end of January last year. This is when I had a little bit too much bourbon and I ended up crashing through a wall, a la the Kool-Aid man in my house. I did a little damage to the corner by where my basement stairs are. I'm actually looking at it right now. It's been mostly repaired at this point. I mean, there's a Sports Illustrated with Brad Park and then another Sports Illustrated with Jim Craig right next to it to kind of distract you from that whole scene. This time I made sure to water down my bourbon a little bit with ice cubes rather than drinking as many of them neat. It was one weird bourbon bottle that looked like it had Don Imus on the front of it. And yeah, we ranked the bourbons that we had during the evening, but I think the main winner was friendship. So we kind of have decided that next year, as we all turn 40, which, by the way, sounds like a bad buddy movie that we might be planning, but as it turns out, I will be going to London to see the Red Sox and the Yankees next June, which I don't understand why I would do this other than for reasons of friendship, given that I could fly to London when it is a lot cheaper to go there, because the price is obviously higher because there's more of a demand with people flying from Boston to see this series between the two ancient baseball rivals. But I've decided to just, throw caution to the wind and say, what the hell? I mean, as I've mentioned before, I could go to Toronto, but I would be walking around Toronto by myself, and I've been there and done that, and it can be a little difficult, going to a city by yourself like that, especially ever since I stopped smoking. It's a little bit harder to, socialize with people. I don't find myself in as many weird and fun situations without being involved in smokers' pits anymore. But hey, at least I feel a lot healthier. So as I get closer to that moment in late June, I may need to seek out some travel tips for the London area for those British listeners to Greetings from Allentown. I also got to do another fun thing that I do once a year, if you'll indulge me. As a graduate of Boston University, like my wife, it was nice to travel 5 minutes from my house to see them actually win a game in Lowell this year, 5-2 on Saturday night. And every single time I had gone since I had moved up to this area closer to Lowell, they had lost every game. Some of them by 7-3 score, where you're just kind of sitting there uncomfortably through the third period. But boys got it done this year. 2 goals by Bobo Carpenter. Very proud of all of them.
Cut off my box, I'll be skating in Florida.
And that's as good a way as I can think of to turn my attention back to Florida and wrestling. Florida, a place that I went to on vacation as a kid many times because I was in a Disney family. So mostly Orlando, but as an adult, I've favored the Fort Myers area more for the Gulf Coast, although apparently we're being forced to go to some timeshare by my wife's family that's on the Atlantic coast, Delray Beach area.
I think there are a lot of shyksters in Florida.
Sure, that might be true in both a literal and a figurative sense, because you got Irwin R. Shyster, the man who would become Irwin R. Shyster, Mike Rotundo, who was the Florida heavyweight champion in late 1987, who then gives the belt as a trophy to Rick Steiner once he wins the NWA World Television title. But Florida has a very rich history of professional wrestling that dates back to 1949, and the name most associated with the territory, which was, as I mentioned, championship wrestling from Florida, is Eddie Graham, who did not have complete control of the territory until 1971. And he's always known as one of those guys, well, he's a great Finnish guy. And there are three great Finnish guys that I can think of that are talked about with great reverence. Eddie Graham is one, Pat Patterson is two, and Peter North is three. And the Florida territory churned out anybody who was anybody, kind of like you got a drink in Hill Valley and Back to the Future. Anybody who's anybody smokes and drinks. They went through the Florida territory at one point or another. Dusty Rhodes was the number one star of this territory, but it produced others like superstar Billy Graham, Hulk Hogan. Basically, if you look at the list of guys who went through the territory, it's pretty much anybody that you would know from the 70s and into the 80s. And this show, of course, focuses mostly on the Dusty Rhodes and Terry Funk feud that was going on in 1989. And they had had feuds in the past, including in 1974. There was some matches between them in 76. In 1982, they were actually partners in a very neat angle, where Terry took the Rolex of his beloved deceased dad, Dory Sr., and gave it to Dusty as a deposit to ensure that, I'm not going to turn on you, Dusty, the way that Ole Anderson did a couple of years before. And you'd think, well, he's still going to turn on him, but he kept to his word, at least for that match. But later in 82, they're once again at each other's throats. And here we are in 1989, back Dusty and Terry Funk, with now Dustin Rhodes involved in all of this. And the other great thing about this PWF promotion is you see so many familiar names. Now, this is the case with Memphis also, but it is interesting to see guys or gals in the quote-unquote before phase. By that, I don't mean ROH or TNA for somebody more modern, or WCW for somebody back in the day. I'm talking territory days like Rick Rude in Memphis, although the best modern example I can come up with is Brian Danielson in 2001 in Memphis Championship Wrestling, I think it was called, having a back and forth with William Regal, which has been on my episode's to-do list for quite some time. And it doesn't even stop at someone like Dustin Rhodes, who was in the Texas Broncos tag team with Kendall Windham in the NWA in late 1988. Just on this show alone, you're seeing the Nasty Boys, who, granted, were both in the AWA prior to this time, but this is before you would see them in either WCW or the WWF. Scott Hall, another guy who was in the AWA, probably when the AWA was a lot more relevant, because he dates all the way back to before the Wrestle Rock Rumble, because hell, he's in that rap video. Another one is Fred Ottman, who is here as the Big Steel Man, and I wish there was more of him on this show, because I love me some Fred Ottman, because he makes me laugh, and also because I had a whole song come up with for his character, the Big Steel Man. If you ever take a trip down to Tampa Bay, Florida, you better get in line, get in your omelet order. You'll be eating some pie. You'll be eating lots of pie. Because a big steel man will make you eat some pie.
better get a fork for some buttermilk pie.
Sure, I could have said French fry instead of just using pie over and over again, but Fred Ottman just makes me think of pie for whatever reason. By the way, throw DDP, Diamond Dallas Page, into that category of guys who become bigger later on, although he, of course, was also in the AWA, and he's actually on commentary with Gordon Solie, unfortunately for us, at least for what we have to put up with him on this show. The PWF was not the most successful thing in the world for the brief period that it was around. It was Florida Championship Wrestling. It was changed to the PWF actually in March, so only about a month, month and a half before this show would have aired, to kind of give it more of a national vibe. When Florida is in the name, you don't really have much of a chance. And actually, back in the day, Florida television would go outside the state. In fact, you could see it as far as New York, which is probably a little bit of a reason why guys from that territory, you know, tended to become stars. It's why people in New York knew who Dusty Rhodes was, because you could see him on TV. But this promotion only lasts through 1991, which is actually kind of surprising that it survived all that time. Steve Kern was basically the standard bearer after Dusty Rhodes left in June to go to the WWF. He actually debuted at the end of May. But then the raid on the PWF from both sides, the WWF and WCW and NWA, because they grab Scott Hall in pretty short order. He's in the NWA by the early summer. Fred Ottman ends up in the WWF as Tugboat eventually. That would take until September when he would debut, which is kind of surprising when I look up those results, because he was a house show only guy. I think of Tugboat as somebody who started right before WrestleMania 6, but he was kind of working house show loops long in advance of that, I guess, maybe to set up the character a little bit. So I do have to warn, again, this is not a complete show. The video is only about 31 and a half minutes. So I kind of wondered how I could get a complete show out of this. And before I get to all of that, of course, this is episode 94. So we have sports moments from 1994. And my sincerest apologies to all the Philadelphia fans who thought I was picking on them by playing the Joe Carter home run. I sincerely was just interested in the fact that there was a Vin Scully call of that particular moment. Hey, bad things happen. I'm doing a show on Florida wrestling when two of my favorite teams had horrific losses down in Florida within the past week, week and a half. Boston Bruins lost two games down in Florida, including a game against the Florida Panthers where they just totally quit from the opening faceoff, and then they lost in Tampa two nights later, and then that Patriots debacle at the end of the game. Hey, let's use Gronk as a defensive back, even though he's got these giant things on his elbow and is very, very fragile and not exactly a sure tackler or anything. So, I don't know, I just needed to get that out there. So I got some sports moments for 1994, and since this show is so heavy on Dusty Rhodes, why don't we take a look at the greatest moment in the career of another guy named Rhodes.
3-2 pitch, swung on, high fly ball, way back, might be, could be, and in! Corner of the left field bleacher. Three balls and the strike. Long drive, way back, it might be! Could be! It is! Holy cow!
And there's a drive! Way back! Oh my goodness, Rhodes! Can you believe it? He has hit three home runs. And there's a curtain.
Carl Tuffy Rhodes isn't the only guy who ever hit three home runs on opening day. In fact, Matt Davidson of the Chicago White Sox did it this past year. But Tuffy hit home runs in his first three at-bats of the season, all of them off Dwight Gooden, which should come with an asterisk. I mean, Dwight Gooden would basically sit out the next season because his drug problem was just out of control. It wasn't a suspension. It was just that he was not the same pitcher that he once was. Three home runs to start out the season, and then his fourth plate appearance, a walk, and then he got a base hit late in the game. But, of course, this being the 94 Cubs, they ended up losing the game to the Mets 12-8. And Tuffy Rhodes, I remember thinking, wow, this guy's going to have a big year. He ended up with 8 home runs in the shortened season, which ended up being a career high in North America for him. He went on to have a pretty good career in Japan, but he made his way over to the Red Sox in 1995. And I remember this because he was starting center fielder for a game I went to in June. It was a Roger Clemens return game, because Clemens came back from the strike completely out of shape, had to go on the DL, didn't start until beginning of June. And Tuffy Rhodes is the Red Sox center fielder filling in for, I don't know if Lee Tinsley was injured or on tour with Hootie and the Blowfish. This is one of those things, I'm sorry. Lee Tinsley, who was a center fielder for the Red Sox at that time, looked exactly like Darius Rucker at the time. You're just going to have to believe me on this, because I don't know if there are literally any pictures out there of Lee Tinsley. So we have, to start out the show, there's no theme in this video. One of the many things that is cut out, but we get some guy who I had put in my notes until I find out that, yes, this is the president of the PWF, Randy Roberts, who is introing and letting everybody know about Homecoming 2, a card coming up in a week down in Florida. And he alludes to the Dusty Rhodes versus Terry Funk feud. But when it comes to presidents of wrestling federations or wrestling associations, this guy, as a public speaker, he makes Jack Tunney sound like Winston Churchill.
The Professional Wrestling Federation of America is very proud to present a card of wrestling matches that involves various wrestling organizations and individual stars from all over the world. On that night, AWA champion Larry Zbysko will defend his title against the challenge of Mike Graham. Also, women's champion Wendy Richter will defend her title against Penelope Paradise.
I don't know, comparing him to Jack Tunney made me think of a universe where Jack Tunney is the guy in the WWF Event Center instead of Sean Mooney for those late 80s, early 90s years. But some of the names there, you get Wendy Richter, which tells you that the AWA is definitely involved, along with the world champion Larry Zbysko, who's down to defend against Mike Graham, which I'm thrilled to tell you there will be an edition of According to Larry coming up later on. Penelope Paradise is a name I have not heard much. Apparently she was local to Florida. And the only match that is on her cage match is a match against Wendy Richter, but from later in 1989, and not this match that would be at Homecoming 2. I thought that that was a little strange. But they go to a clip of an actual wrestling match, which is in very short supply on this show. But unfortunately, it's from almost 2 months before at Homecoming 1. Clip of Dustin Rhodes versus Terry Funk. First thing we see is a big backdrop by young Dustin, and then an elbow to the top of the head. Because young Dustin was really just kind of a carbon copy of his father. And he didn't really find himself as truly like Dustin Rhodes, his own man, I don't think, until at least 1992. Because 91 in WCW, he's pretty much just doing a pale imitation of Daddy. And in 90, he was just kind of a piece that was there to further the DiBiase feud and then to build up to that tag match so that Virgil could then split up. And then a two count by Dustin. And Oliver Humperdinck gets in the ring because he's seconding Terry Funk for some reason, who somehow needs a manager. But where Dusty Rhodes is, Oliver Humperdinck probably not far behind, since those two were pretty tight. And Dustin just kind of drags him and beats him up, which he's probably always wanted to do as like a friend of his dad's who's always around the house. I don't know if he's laying in stiff shots or anything. But Terry Funk takes this opportunity to tie up Dustin's leg like he's mutton busting or something like that. If you've never been to like the rodeo and you got to see like the 8-year-old kids going mutton busting, oh, you have not lived until you have seen that. So anyway, yeah, Funk gets DQ'd there, and he now starts swinging a chair at Yeah, very carefully swinging the chair as well at the ankle, and then he focuses on the knee with three swings. And finally, some baby faces hit the ring to make the save, including the Nasty Boys, Knobs and Sags, who I mentioned earlier, are very much a staple of this territory and held the tag team titles, I believe, on five occasions. So this Dusty Rhodes-Terry Funk match, it's not just any regular wrestling match, because that's just not going to do for a rivalry that stretches back 15 years. It's going to be a, as they put it, a Texas death match. Now, I don't know why everything has to be a Texas death match. I get it, because both guys are from Texas, but what is a Florida death match? Is that like you get heat stroke waiting in line at Disney World or something like that? I think that's what that is. This one is also bunkhouse rules, so you know Dusty is definitely involved when you hear the word bunkhouse. And that'll be, of course, on May 6th at Homecoming No. 2, which coincidentally the night before WrestleWar 89, as I mentioned earlier, where Terry Funk would certainly make an impact with Ric Flair after that match, asking for the title shot. So the Funker was busy, and Ric Flair was totally out of line saying that he was in Hollywood. It just showed me that Ric Flair was just not paying attention to the PWF, which rightfully so, considering the fact that Flair and Dusty were not particularly on good terms.
I saw the man slam the commander.
He slammed Knobs, right? I saw him slam Knobs.
Yeah, he slammed Knobs, but before that, Sag slammed Commando Ray.
We just had an instant replay. The boys in the back would have put up the right one.
This is the challenge of the incomplete show that is maybe even in the wrong order and maybe even using clips from other shows, but just saying that it's the April 30th PWF show, because it's a very awkward cut to Gordon Solie and Diamond Dallas Page, our announcers for this show, if we had any more matches. And DDP is not yet a wrestler at this point. He hasn't even made his debut, but that would actually be coming soon. But he's still kind of in his AWA mode. And it's a hard time trying to figure out what exactly they're talking about. But it's really no different than when I sit here on Monday night, and I often record this podcast on Monday night while Monday Night Raw is playing on the television, and I could be staring at it at the time, where it turns into a bit of a choose-your-own-adventure thing where I'm kind of making up backstories for guys in my head. Like, for example, this past Monday when I see the Authors of Pain with Drake Maverick, who's like an inch, you know, a foot and a half, I mean, shorter than they are. I just had this image of Drake Maverick is the 13-year-old kid brother of the girl that they're dating, who's like 20, and they're tolerating him hanging around with them because they just really want to get laid, and that she's a real, you know, she's really dynamite in the sack or something like that. I don't know. I kind of invented that whole story with the Authors of Pain and that. So here, I think what's happening is it was some sort of body slam with Jerry Sags and Commando Ray, who you might know better as Kareem Muhammad, back in Memphis, but he is also the trainer of New Jack. So anytime you see New Jack put on a short arm scissors or figure four leg lock or something like that, please know that Commando Ray, aka Kareem Muhammad, is partly responsible for this. DDP is wearing, this kind of shows that maybe he's on the cutting edge of pop culture, a Batman shirt. And with it being 1989, I thought, well, clearly the movie must be out, and that's why he's wearing the shirt. No, movie wouldn't be out for another 7-8 weeks after this. It's June 23rd, which I have to imagine that Batman was supposed to come out Memorial Day weekend, and then they moved it away from that date because they didn't want to run into that buzzsaw at the box office that was No Holds Barred. So things come to a screeching halt as Oliver Humperdinck stops by, and he's lost the Technicolor Dreamcoat that was either stolen in Jim Crockett Promotions or he had to leave it in the WWF, although I think he was still wearing that when he was with Bigelow in JCP towards the end of 88. And we get this heartfelt union of the two men who would go on to ruin the Freebirds in 1991 between DDP and Oliver Humperdinck, who would go by the name Big Daddy Dink. But luckily, no matter how much Humperdinck and Page might annoy us, Terry Funk saunters out to the set. And he is here to save us and to lead us to the promised land, like the Moses of professional wrestling that he is. Today, the Funker is going to sit us down and tell us a story.
Once upon a time when I was a child, I had a jackass. My father walked up to that jackass, cocked a gun, and blew that jackass's brains out. Now, I said to my father, "Daddy, why did you do that to my jackass?" He said, "Because that jackass was fat and useless." There are some fat and useless things in the state of Florida. One fat thing that is useless in the state of Florida is the city of Miami.
Oh, come on
because
now.
Because it is fat with pollution and decadence. And the only reason that I would go into that rat hole is to rid this state of something that is also fat and useless. Fat on its own ego, that is the PWF champion, Dusty Rhodes. Yes, you are the world's champion. But yes, I am here to wrestle you in a Texas death match. But why can't you, Dusty Rhodes, why can't you put your belt on the line? You and Randy Roberts, the president of the Federation, are ducking and dodging who? You are ducking and dodging Terry Funk because I am down here with a reason and I am going to that stinking rat hole
to accomplish
what I've wanted to,
yeah.
And I will accomplish it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. Now, this is wonderful.
Geez, if they were referring to Dory Funk Sr. as something of a shooter, I don't think this is what they were talking about. But, whew, that's pretty rough. Of course, upbringings in Texas were different back in the day, so that's fine. I'm not going to judge, okay? I mean, it seems like, you know, him and Dory Jr. turned out fine. How many times can I say jackass in one promo? I think Terry went out there kind of thinking that, similar to Sean Mooney with how many puns he could make in one Virgil versus Iron Mike Sharp match from 1993. You got to keep yourself interested somehow. And his remarks about pollution, I think, may have unwittingly created the monster known as Ludwig Borga.
Look at this filth, this pollution.
I mean, it was a good point. I mean, they're probably more focused on the beaches and keeping that clean because that's getting the tourism dollars, especially in Miami area and on the Gulf Coast as well. But maybe if you're concerned about the Everglades, take it up with Steve Kern. Maybe you get something with him, you know, since he's the one hanging out there and all that. And as they go to what appears to be a commercial, they tell us that coming up next, Slater and Gator, the team of Slater and Gator is coming up next. And I thought to myself, holy crap, they are booking WWE tag teams 25 years in advance with Slater Gator, the later team of Heath Slater and Titus O'Neil. Now, of course, this team is actually Dick Slater and Gator Steve Kern. So an upgrade from both Heath Slater and Titus O'Neil. This is another one of those lost matches. I think it might have been against the Commandos. I'm not sure. Maybe it would have been a lesser team for TV. Slater and Kern is a pretty strong tag team for the Florida territory. And Slater is there, obviously, because wherever Terry Funk goes, you have to have Dick Slater there in reserve. It's kind of like when you're playing fantasy football and you have Todd Gurley on your team, the running back for the Rams. Well, you also want to pick up the backup running back for the Rams just in case Gurley gets hurt so that you'll, you know, have somebody who will get the touches maybe that Todd Gurley would have. Dick Slater is like that backup running back to Terry Funk. Let's say Terry Funk is kind of like Thurman Thomas for the Buffalo Bills at that time, except Terry Funk would not have lost his helmet and not been available for the first play of a Super Bowl, like what happened to Thurman Thomas. And that means, I guess, Dick Slater is Kenneth Davis which I guess is somewhat apropos. He's good, but not exactly threatening Thurman Thomas for the starting job. And when Funk goes to the NWA, who do you think turns up there shortly thereafter? Why, Dick Slater. And not only that, he is filling in for the injured Terry Funk, teaming with the great Muda at Clash of the Champions 8 against the team of Ric Flair and Sting.
From the hold of Tom Tupa, they go for two. Tupa puts his head down and runs it in for a two-point conversion. Right now is the point where we can start to put him away.
1994 was the year the NFL adopted the two-point conversion, and that was actually the first successful two-point play. And in fact, I think the first one attempted, which, of all things, the Cleveland Browns decided to fake an extra point, which I'm surprised you didn't see as much of back in the day, because you could take it by surprise. I guess it's because you don't want to use your good fake field goal play for something that's only going to give you one additional point over an extra point. I guess I understand it from that perspective. But on that play, Tom Tupa, as the holder, just took the snap and ran it up the middle. And Tupa would become, well, kind of famous for scoring a bunch of two-point conversions that season. But later in 1999, he would play quarterback for the New York Jets on opening day when Vinny Testaverde blew out his Achilles tendon. And the backup quarterback in that game for the Jets was Rick Meyer, but he was listed as the third quarterback and thus could not be inserted into the game until the fourth quarter. Otherwise, they would have lost use of Tom Tupa, and then they wouldn't have had a punter. So Tom Tupa is always kind of a fun little footnote in football history because he broke into the league as a quarterback but was a very well-regarded punter in college, and then eventually he became a punter in the NFL. I think it had something to do with the fact that as a punter in college, he would take three steps with the ball, and in the NFL, that really wasn't going to work for whatever reason. I don't know. This is way more time on Tom Tupa than I was expecting. So we're back with Gordon, and he mentions that Larry Zbyszko is coming in, and I do think that it was a worthwhile shot that they were taking, even though the AWA was pretty much dead. It is kind of a name to bring in. Maybe it's not going to draw a whole heck of a lot, but it's certainly better than nothing. And speaking of nothing, they go back to Randy Roberts. And if you want to know what his background is and how he became the president of the PWF, he's actually a business partner of Dusty Rhodes, apparently. Dusty actually did discuss who Randy Roberts was in his book, which is entitled Dusty, Reflections of Wrestling's American Dream. And he goes on to say, I brought a friend of mine by the name of Randy Roberts in with me, who had a strong business background in casino management with Caesars Tahoe and corporate startups, with the hopes that we could turn Florida back around. But we just couldn't do it. We didn't fail for lack of trying, however. We ran the office and television right back out of the old CWF office at 106 North Albany in Tampa, home of the famous and somewhat infamous Sportatorium. We were on the air all over the state. We ran the town's weekly like we did in the heyday, trying to recapture the old lightning in a bottle. Everyone involved busted their ass to make that venture work, but the bolt never stuck. It's kind of weird how last week I play that casino guy plugging WrestleMania 9 at Caesar's Palace, and now we get this Randy Roberts guy who actually also worked for Caesar's and is now pimping wrestling shows for the PWF. It's another one of those weird coincidences, like me seeing the Wild Bill Irwin, Tito Santana, you know, El Matador match. He runs down the card, which included a $10,000 bounty match between Bam Bam Bigelow and Manny Fernandez. Now, that's a pretty badass team. And on the other side, you have Dustin Rhodes and Scott Hall. So if you ever wondered why Dusty Rhodes would have been sympathetic to the NWO, deep down in that very sizable soul of his, it's because, you know, Scott Hall helped this kid out back in 89. He always had a soft spot for Scott Hall. It's a very simple explanation if you want to extrapolate that back from 1998. And Steve Kern versus Al Perez for the Florida title. That match would end up in a draw. And Dick Slater took on the Big Steel Man in a pie-on-a-pole match. Actually, it was a taped fist boxing match of some kind. And, of course, the feud of the century with Dusty Rhodes and Terry Funk. And they show a short clip of a bull rope match with Terry Funk and Dusty Rhodes from 1974. And there's more of this out there on YouTube. There's about a 5-minute clip, I believe, of this that exists. And Dusty had only turned babyface in 1973, so he's very early on into his run as a babyface, which would pretty much last for the rest of his career. And he's dominating in this clip before they go, both end up on their knees. They do that last battle of Atlanta, just kind of slugging it out spot. And then there's a quick clip of Terry Funk as the NWA champion, which was about a year after it. Actually, this was in 1976. And Funk had faced somebody for the title, and he had retained, and Dusty had challenged the winner to a match after that one. So, of course, now you're supposed to get Dusty versus Terry Funk. But it's a little unfair in the psychology of it that the babyface is challenging like that with all the odds in his favor. And he hits Funk a few times, just kind of pounds on him for a little bit, and then Terry just kind of takes off with the belt. So kind of much ado about nothing. And I had mentioned their feud in 1982, and they don't play the clip from this, but the Terry Funk, you know, offering up his dad's Rolex as a deposit is such brilliant storytelling. I absolutely love that. So the AWA championship match with Larry Zbyszko, as I said, a worthwhile gamble, I think. Mike Graham as the opponent, well, I understand he is the son of Eddie Graham, and that might be why he's in this spot. He's in that famous family. We're in Florida. Fine. I've never been particularly thrilled with any of Mike Graham's work that I've seen over the years, particularly in those Legends of Wrestling where he comes off as particularly obnoxious, but not in like the fun way, you know, like you'd see Nick Bockwinkel in that show on the 70s where he just said he was better than everybody else. And who are we to doubt the original gangster, Nick Bockwinkel? And of course, it was a really sad end for Mike Graham, who committed suicide. I forget what year it was, but it's sad because there's a whole history of it in that family. Eddie Graham killed himself on Super Bowl Sunday in 1985, and then I believe Mike Graham's son also killed himself too. So very similar to the Von Erichs, if you know, it doesn't quite get as much attention in the mainstream. It almost seems to be more of a wrestling community sort of thing.
You know, Randy, I've had many tough, hard matches in Miami. Coming to Miami in the Knight Center for homecoming, too, wrestling against the legend, Larry Zbyszko. Who does he think he is? I was around when he started. He used to carry my bag to the dressing room. So, Mr. Zbyszko, you come on down to Florida where legends are put to rest and reality comes alive. And when the party's all over and the match is done, I'm going to take that new belt. And I'm going to go down and see Toby at the Facade and party like everybody else, all the human beings do. And other than that, my good friend has got a brand new 50-foot cigarette waiting for me, David Gilmore down at the dock. We're going to tear Miami up like it hadn't seen in a long time. And Zbyszko, you're going to be crying on your way back to the Snowbirds.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not buying Mike Graham as the AWA champion, even in 1989. I'm sorry, because even though he might be well-connected, he's got a car waiting for him, that's fine down in Florida. I mean, take that for what it's worth. But all I heard from that promo is, you have surpassed me greatly, Larry Zbyszko, with the whole, you were here, you know, when doing nothing when I was great, and now he's the world champion, and you're still there in what is a, I don't want to say a flailing promotion, because it's certainly a lot of fun, but, you know, come on, let's be realistic here, Mike Graham. I mean, I really don't want to speak ill of the dead here, so I'll really just find anything else to talk about. You know where I can do that? ProWrestlingOnly.com, where I can explore other podcasts, along with match reviews, features and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, and matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows and movies, and more. You can join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members in an archive of 1.8 million threads. I don't know the number. I haven't added it lately, so that's merely an estimate. But the message board is a vibrant community. Whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope form, like examining Mike Graham's career, for example, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com. We go back to Gordon Solie and DDP, but only for 1 second, because then it cuts away to DDP just by himself. And I can't help but laugh at the way DDP phrases this.
Because when Diamond Dallas Page comes, baby, he don't come empty-handed.
That's a strange way of putting things, especially since he changed out of his Batman shirt and into a Guns N' Roses shirt. So maybe he got stains on it. I don't want to ask too many questions of what's going on, but all I know is I heard what I heard, and there's really no explanation for anything else. This could be a different week that's been inserted into this video. I don't know. But Oliver Humperdinck is there, and this is what he's referring to about not coming empty-handed, apparently. And he is wheeling out a box. And when you have a box on a wrestling program, you just immediately think, well, what could this possibly be? This is a classic bit that they're doing here. The first thing you think of is it a cake? And you think, well, maybe Dusty would be interested in having cake. But the problem with that is the big steel man would have eaten it all backstage. And secondly, Jim Cornette isn't there to have his face thrown into it. Although, the Midnight Express did leave the NWA around this time. So if they had come down to Florida, I'm sure Cornette would have gotten his face shoved in my proposed cake. Anyway, is it a snake? Like the, you know, the wedding reception that attacked Elizabeth? Well, Jake Roberts isn't there, and he's got to stay the hell out of Florida, because that is actually where he got arrested and put into some legal trouble around this time in 1989. So it's not going to be a snake. Is it a miniaturized version of Oliver Humperdinck? I doubt that, although when you look at Oliver Humperdinck, you think of him, he looks like the world's largest munchkin from The Wizard of Oz. Something like that. So that's a distinct possibility. Or did they do that douchebag move where is there another box inside that box, which then has another box inside of that? Probably not, because I would take up a lot of time on this program. And I certainly hope not in a 31-minute, 33-second video. So let's see what it is. Because Dusty, he was backstage unclogging a toilet, as is my understanding, and that's why it took him a little while to get out there. But he had to toss on that black leather jacket to really make this work.
The bottom line is, I want to make amends. I want to make amends for everything that's happened with us. I want to get everything down here. Let me, you're gonna love it, man. This is something specially for you. This is made in the heavens above, strictly for you, baby. Here, hold this for me, hump. What'd you put? Is this the one on the floor? This one right here. Oh yeah. Hey, look at this stuff. How about it, Dusty? We got this girl just for you, Daddy.
Look at that, huh?
Now that's the kind of Diamond Doll Dusty one. Look at that, huh?
And yes, it is a young lass who comes out of the box and gives Dusty a hug. She has several tears in her jeans, I guess, as the style was at the time. So I guess Dusty, as the 80s went along, from like 85 and 86... he's now gone from baby doll to a diamond doll. And who knows what happened in between. Maybe if we had found out what was in that damn envelope that I examined several weeks ago or several shows ago, maybe we would know. But there was more than just a pretty woman in that box.
Look at that. Looks good, baby. Looks good on you. It looks good on you. You ain't got nothing I won't.
But that ain't the only thing I brought.
Nothing I need.
That ain't the only thing I brought.
You ain't got nothing that what you gave me.
That ain't the only thing.
You better play with some good.
It ain't the only thing I brought you, baby. It ain't the only thing.
That's how you walked out.
That's who it is.
Oh, man, this is terrible.
Get on him.
That's Terry Funkel came jumping out of that box, and now he's wheeling that chain on the leg of Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. And we've got a real problem going here, as we've got him scattering all over the place.
Funk box, we can't get out. Lock the door, call the cops. Funk box, we can't get out. Lock the door, call the cops.
In fulfillment of the prophecy in 1981 by the Sugar Hill Gang, in their song Funk Box. Terry Funk emerges from the box, hits Dusty with something. I can't quite pick up on what that was, but beats him down for a little bit. And then Blonde, Scott Hall, Dustin, Knobs, Sags, they all come out and make the save for good old Dusty. And if this all sounds very familiar, the whole little box angle, for a more modern fan, although it's funny that I would say a more modern fan, considering that this only took place 2.5 years later. In 1991, WCW, Sting started getting these mysterious boxes from some sort of benefactor. And then at Clash of the Champions 17, Medusa comes out of the box and does a belly dance for Sting, in which Sting acts like a complete child, like he had never seen a woman before, kind of underscoring the lack of coolness that Sting would sometimes display. Well, there was a second box, and Abdullah the Butcher jumped out and attacked Sting. Now, who booked that angle in 1991? Why, it was Dusty Rhodes booking WCW at that time. So clearly he remembered something like this and how it could work and wanted to give it another shot.
I just got my ass blasted for giving them hell down in West Virginia, and here you get a hell of a job right here today. Good job. Three class guys, and you pick them out here and single them out. You can't get any of them to threaten the guys. Shut up, guys. That's why I was telling my kid to knock your kid in the mouth. Standing there pushing in the game.
For some of these obscure ones, I really need to provide some context. So this is February of 1994, and Temple University had just lost to University of Massachusetts Amherst. It was a huge rivalry at the time. I talked about it a little bit when I was talking about UMass in 1992, but these teams, I think one of them was number 8 and one of them was number 13 at the time. Hard-fought game at UMass. So John Calipari, the UMass coach, is giving his press conference. John Chaney, in a total professional wrestling move, the coach of Temple, walks out and basically cuts a promo, basically the equivalent of cutting a promo from the top of the ramp on Monday Night Raw on Calipari, tells him to shut up. By the way, Chaney is 62 years old at the time, and when I see you, I'm going to kick your ass! Kick your ass! And his issue was that Calipari was working the officials like crazy when Chaney thought, you know, they were doing okay, and that Chaney had gotten in trouble with the A-10, as he mentioned, for a game down in West Virginia earlier that week. This is the second game that week that Temple lost. So they went down, I think, 5 or 6 spots in the AP poll. So just something kind of funny that gets lost in the whole Nancy Kerrigan and OJ thing of 1994. In a quintessential Philadelphia sports moment, even if it's not the Sixers, Flyers, Eagles, or Phillies, this is, you know, one of the college teams in the city, Temple University. That's why I told my kid, your kid in the mouth. Chaney actually got suspended for one game because of that. I can't even imagine if this happened today. There would be like a trillion videos of it on Twitter almost immediately. But back then, you have to like wait. Any time I could see that footage, it was great. So another plug for Homecoming 2, which I said, kind of a disappointing draw when you consider the amount of effort being put into this, 850 people. I'm thinking Dusty Rhodes versus Terry Funk in 1989. How far would I travel by car to see that match if it was coming anywhere close to my area? And I decided that 100 miles would suffice. So I would basically go from where I live to Hartford. So if Dusty was facing Terry Funk in Hartford, I would probably actually drive there for that, and I would just figure out a way to go. And apparently now they've clarified that Dick Slater versus the Big Steel Man is a taped fist match. So boxing, taped fist, I guess it's all the same. But the most important thing is that the AWA champion is coming to town, because PWF has seen how successful the series, according to Larry, has been, that they want to bring that kind of magic to their promotion. Now, as I've run this several times, but Warren's mentioning once again that Larry Zbyszko kind of reminds me in many ways of Jim Belushi in terms of his annoyingness. You know, Belushi kind of playing off his brother John Belushi. Larry Zbyszko can't go more than 20 minutes, probably less than that, without mentioning Bruno Sammartino. So I've created a show called According to Larry, just like the show According to Jim, which aired on the ABC television network. You don't remember that? You don't remember According to Jim back in the 2000s? Well, I do. So let's see what Larry Zbyszko has to say about his upcoming sojourn to the Sunshine State.
What you got to ask yourself, Mr. Graham, is do you really want to face me? Do you really want to get in the ring? Because when you do, and when you lose, you fall all the way back down that mountain, and you never get to Larry Land. You'll never get to be what I am, the heavyweight wrestling champion of the world.
And you know what else Larry is a guy wearing a pink turtleneck under his jacket, which is kind of funny because if he wears that in that pink room that the AWA would eventually start taping their TV in, he would just completely blend into the wall and nobody would be able to see him. That'd be so great. Larry Land kind of sounds like one of those unsuccessful Disney parks that they developed over the years. Kind of like, I think it's Discovery Island, that place that is an island in the middle of a pond that they just completely abandoned at some point in the mid-90s. I think Larry Land within Disney was somewhere in that.
Miami, May 6th, the Night Center. Everybody's talking about it. World title on the line. $10,000 bounty.
There's an old saying, a little bit of Oliver Humperdinck will go a long way, and none of him will go even further. I'm surprised Terry Funk didn't get him confused with Red from Roadhouse, the feature film that Terry Funk be appearing in, coming out in theaters shortly after this point, and I actually just put a 30-second ad for the movie Roadhouse on my YouTube channel. Be sure to subscribe. I don't have a Patreon, but that's a way to support me, because if I get to 1,000 subscribers, I can actually get Google revenue again. Which certainly would be nice. So, DDP there again. But quickly, we get another cut back to Gordon, who is with the Nasty Boys. And I am anxious to hear from Rob Dibble, Norm Charlton, and Randy Myers, because the Reds are in first place at this time in 1989, and I'm wondering if the investigation of Pete Rose and his gambling issues is at all a distraction. Wait, what? Oh, wait, this is the Nasty Boys, Brian Knobbs and Jerry Sex. Yeah, I knew that.
How's everybody doing in Miami? It's business as usual for the Nasty Boys. Rocking and rolling, strutting and strolling.
Jeez, I know you guys were in the AWA with the Rockers, but I don't like this plagiarism, just like we had a couple of weeks ago with Coco Beware, where we discovered that he was lifting Rocky Johnson lines from the year before. But fine, let's see if Brian Knobbs can do any better.
That's right. Let me tell you something sad. I got chills. I got chills and they're multiplying. And I'm losing control. Because the power the Nasty Boys are supplying is electrifying. So get ready, Bobby Jaggers. Get ready, Blackport. Because you're going down. And after we have the belt, we're going to watch the greatest matches in professional wrestling history.
Geez, I don't know what the hell happened there. It kind of sounded like the emergency broadcast system was going to break into the middle of Brian Knobbs' promo, which actually, that would not be a bad way for me to kind of alternate that with the Gap Band blowing up the promo thing that I've been doing.
This is a test. For the next minute, this station will conduct a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test.
Well, I presume that that'll be fine unless the test we're talking about is Andrew Martin. Now, if you ever wanted to hear Gordon Solie do a live commercial read on the air, well, today is your lucky day.
And to Gulf Southern Enterprises Painting and Drywall Contractors and to DeVoe Paint.
Jeez, I could have used those guys when I did my Kool-Aid Man thing many months ago. So Bobby Jaggers and Black Bart are in the ring, and Terry Funk is just sort of wandering around. I'm looking at Black Bart, and I think, boy, that guy has not missed a meal since he got to the Florida territory. I do like how you can see in the background the PWF banner, but they also kept the FCW banner also. It's like they're my mom in this promotion, and they just don't throw anything away at all. And Dustin Rhodes, I don't understand the full context for what's going on, but he just kind of charges into the ring, probably because Terry Funk is there, and Terry bails, and Bobby Jaggers gets overwhelmed by Dustin, and then Steve Kern jumps in there to get at Black Bart. Again, don't understand if there's a long-standing issue between those two. Dustin, though, once again, he gets tied up in the bull rope at the bottom of his leg, like he did earlier. He's kind of reminding me of Wile E. Coyote here, which I guess would make Terry Funk the Roadrunner. So he drags Dustin across the floor. So now Dusty is out with a weapon to make the save on behalf of his son. And they end up fighting all the way through what appears to be like a loading dock area, or for whatever that is worth. And Terry, when he gets an edge on Dusty, they're near kind of the exit, and there is a truck there. So like any sensible human being, Terry Funk decides that he's going to tie Dusty Rhodes to the tailgate of his truck. It is going to drag him away.
We're trying to get that truck started.
Typical Rhodes sneaking in on him again there.
That looks like Dustin on the other side, pounding away at Terry Funk. What? And meanwile...
What is wrong?
Oh, man, they're trying to...
Where's Dustin? Now, Dusty, there he is again. Play it possum, man.
Dusty's got the three of it, and he's got...
All he wants to do is give him a free ride to Miami, baby.
He's got Terry Funk in trouble. He's pulling him out of that truck now. And Dusty Rhodes, brother, and I've seen some angry individuals in my entire lifetime, but I have never seen any one person as angry as I am seeing now. This team of Dustin and Dusty Rhodes.
They can't beat them one at a time.
What a combination these two make. And so Terry Funk had in mind, no question about it, Terry Funk had in mind that he was going to try and drag Dusty behind him in that pickup truck. But thank goodness that... That was circumvented by Dustin Rhodes.
It's a good thing that truck did not start. And I'm not going to make a wise alecky crack about American trucks of the 1980s, because that would be too easy. But what I think happened is that that truck got brought into a repair shop, and somebody didn't do a very good job on it. I wonder who that could have been down in Florida working on cars.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, you can trust your car to the man that wears the star.
This feud is so deep that I would be surprised if sabotage like that was actually happening. Also, the fact that I don't think Dusty would have been very good at repairing cars, because his mind was scattered all over the place. He got his pizza business, he got his plumbing business, he's got his butcher shop. Way too many, you know, hats that he's trying to wear at one time. By the way, could we have had a little bit less talking from Diamond Dallas Page during that? Because every time Gordon tries to say something, DDP is like yelling over him, and then you can't hear either one of them. It's like listening to the worst sports radio show you can think of.
You know how the champion likes to go way back. He likes to see what's happening. He wants to get his competitors into the ring. Dusty did that to him. He set Jaggers up, set his son out there, set him up for the big league. He's playing possum in the back. There was nothing to matter with. Like, it's quite obvious for him.
No, it was quite obvious to me that he came out there just barely moving.
DDP is so bad on commentary here that I think he kept people out of the building for Homecoming 2. Yeah, you got Dusty Rhodes and Terry Funk, but they also thought, well, there's also Diamond Dallas Page, and he's freaking horrible, and he's ruining the TV, and he keeps interrupting Gordon Solie, so we're not going to go, because it's just terrible. Although, I do have one critique for Gordon when he kind of comments on this whole scene.
Well, that's one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen.
You say that so much, it's lost all meaning.
Yeah, between that and the dirty white boy a couple of episodes ago down at Continental and his heinous actions against Dr. Tom Pritchard, might want to ease up there a little bit, Gordon. I mean, you're starting to turn into Tony Schiavone, where everything is the biggest thing in the history of our sport.
Why? I don't know, some hard black stick.
That is literally what she said. Talk about stuff that was like a pro wrestling storyline from 1994. You think Chaney and Calipari was, you know, that was just kind of your typical promo battle. A lot more intrigue with the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing. It's kind of amazing that Tonya Harding never made her way to either WWF or WCW in the late 90s, when you consider that in June of 94, not long after this, she made an appearance in AAA as the manager of Los Gringos Locos, who you may know better as Art Barr and Yeah, Eddie Guerrero. Just kind of funny how things work out like that. So as the show is kind of coming to a halt with me getting annoyed by both Gordon and DDP, we got Terry Funk coming out now to once again take us back to the promised land.
Here comes Terry Funk.
You think that impresses me? Do you think the Dusty Rhodes impresses me? What he can do to me.
Hey, don't you do it. Hang on, just a moment. I don't care what you are.
You are a part of this.
Come on, don't do it, Sully.
I don't care if he's an old man. I don't care about you.
Terry had grabbed Gordon Solie, thinking that he was in on this deep state conspiracy that was conspiring against Terry Funk. And for what it's worth, Oliver Humperdinck was trying to keep him from hitting Gordon Solie, to his credit, I guess. But that draws out Dusty Rhodes, and they brawl all over the studio once again. And I noticed that the rest of the roster comes out and starts fighting too, but exclusively in the background of what's happening, because the camera is focused on Funk and Rhodes, just, you know, because this is the most important feud, and that's what the camera is focused on. So you can see, like, Brian Knobs in the background, and you're thinking, okay, so everybody else is fighting. I certainly hope they're not laying in stiff shots like the Nasty Boys might become known for later, considering that they're not even on camera, and absolutely nobody would see it. Even the people who are actually there probably couldn't see it that well. But Dusty and Terry, they're both delivering. And Terry Funk kind of does that slip and slide thing where he's like off balance momentarily that he does in all the brawls, like the barroom brawl on the TNT episode that I covered in episode 30. So, yeah, kind of weird. And even stranger is that Gordon Solie says, we're out of time, but not for our video, because there's still a good 5 minutes left. But in the course of this is very confusing, actually, watching through this, because you're at the 26-minute mark, there's still 5 minutes to go, but now you get credits rolling, and it's got this music playing, where, and I like it all, I like the credits, and then they show us what happened on the show, but it's all the matches that we didn't get to see, it's all stuff, so like, I can't see and extrapolate what is going on, what we missed from this show. But I guess it really doesn't matter because they gave me my closing credits as it scrolls through. It looks like Gordon Solie's son was the director-producer of this. And they keep calling it Florida Championship Wrestling. So now I'm very confused because they're hanging up both banners. Like, really not the most focused marketing I've ever seen. But hey, what are you going to do? This does remind me of the time that I went to see the movie The Untouchables in the theater. It was a special showing of it in 2000 when I was in college. The theater near where my dorm was at that time used to show old movies on Friday night at midnight. And I went and saw The Untouchables. And what happened was they screwed up the order of the reels or something like that. So we saw the first third of the movie at the beginning. Then we saw the last third of the movie. And then they played the middle third of the movie at the end. They offered refunds and all, but it was kind of jarring when, and spoiler alert, if you haven't seen this 31-year-old film, you get through the first third of the movie, and then it starts the last third, and Sean Connery is all of a sudden in a pool of blood and dead on the floor. So somebody got up and was like, you killed Sean Connery! Oh, well, whatever. I went back the next week. I forget what they were playing, but they had some sort of prize giveaway, and they gave me some Radiohead CD that I don't think I ever opened, now that I think about it. I should check to see if I still have that. So, as I said, there's a little bit more on this, and we have a Dusty Rhodes promo. Now, I'm going to plug my YouTube again, because I posted a bunch of Dusty stuff from WCW Prime, primarily what I covered in episode 37. Now, Dusty, he's a classic sports front runner. If there ever was one. He's a Celtics fan in the 1980s. He's wearing a Yankees jacket in that 1988 Worldwide episode that we saw not that long ago. I'm sure if he was still an active competitor in 92 and 93, he would have been wearing Dallas Cowboys stuff. I'm not sure that Dusty Rhodes even knows what hockey is, so we can just kind of ignore that. But here, he is in his white shirt than he was before. But for whatever reason, he's wearing an Oakland A's hat, which I found kind of funny and random. Like, why would Dusty be wearing an Oakland A's hat? And then you look and you see, oh yeah, that's right. They had the Bash Brothers then, defending American League champions, and would go on to win the World Series in 1989. I posted a picture of Twitter, the screen cap of Dusty the A's hat, saying it was the acquisition of Dusty Rhodes that propelled the A's to a World Series championship in 1989. I don't know about that, but there was a guy named Dusty Rhodes in the 1954 World Series who hit a pair of home runs. He had game-winning hits, including a walk-off home run in extra innings of Game 1, and then another home run in Game 2. He probably would have been the MVP of that World Series if they were giving that award at that time. And it's funny because they didn't start giving that award until 1955, so the very next year. So let's take a look at what the other Bash brother, the one who never took any steroids, I can assure you, Dusty Rhodes, what he had to say about what's going on.
You know, Dusty Rhodes has faced all kind of adversity. Just a week ago, had to take it out into the street in Pulikiuwil. And all the blacks and the browns and the yellows and the reds and the greens, the yellow people throughout this country know Flamingo Madness is now on fire. They know I am faced with my sternest test in the likes of Al Perez, the big steel man in a steel cage, defending Professional Wrestling Federation heavyweight title. And then I go home now, my family will be looking at me and saying, how long will this go on with Terry Funk? How long will this continue to be a public matter? Will Terry Funk grab a seat, hold on tight? Because Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, now puts an end to the feud that for 15 years has rocked the wrestling world, has reeled nations across from Europe to Japan. Miami Night Center, Terry Funk and Dusty Rhodes, the final chapter, the ending chapter, the feud of feuds. If I have to take you in the streets, I'm going to do it.
The audio then gets distorted for a bit to the point where I thought that Max Headroom was going to somehow invade the telecast, but it was a good promo by Dusty. Maybe not his best. It kind of sounds more like a parody of quote-unquote serious Dusty Rhodes that you would see before that WWF tenure where things just got very, very silly. But Terry Funk is going to get the last word, but of course we get a quick cut to somebody standing in the ring, which is completely cut out because we can't have wrestling matches on this particular video. No, sir. Terry Funk's rebuttal, because he's the home, well, technically he's not the home team, but he's getting the last at bat here. And I don't know where he's doing this promo, but it appears to be that he's using the same stuff that Queen Sherry would use with the whole cauldron thing from SummerSlam 1989 later that year. So maybe Terry Funk ended up selling all that sort of stuff to Sherry to kind of make money on the deal after he's done with this promo.
A microwave with an impacted ego. It's because I have made him eat every bit of his pride, bite by bite, to where there is just a shell of a man left. But am I satisfied with that? No. I want to crush the shell into a thousand pieces. And how can I do that? By challenging him to a Texas chain match massacre. That's right. I'm sure you're scared, Dusty. I'm sure that you're shaking right now. But where can you hide? Are you going to crawl back into your past? Even if you do that, what happens when you turn the lights on? Oh, you are confronted with your worst nightmare. Accept my invitation to a massacre.
And that is it for the video, but I'm left wanting just one more thing to kind of put the capper on this episode that is so centered around Terry Funk and Dusty Rhodes and their feud from 1989. It is one of the funniest things you'll ever see, where Funk is in front of this, what appears to be a wooden sort of, I was going to say Pillsbury Doughboy looking thing, but it's not quite as plump as the Pillsbury Doughboy. It has Dusty written on it so that there's no mistaking who Terry Funk is talking about, and just hilarity ensues.
Let's talk about something that all of you people want to talk about out there. Let's increase your intelligence. I'm going to increase your vocabulary now by teaching you out there a new word. And do you know what that new word is? The new word is a Dusty. And what is a Dusty? A Dusty is a 150-pound frame with 50 pounds of added fat, 50 pounds of added obesity, and 50 pounds of hot air. If you combine those all together, what do you have? You have a 300-pound blob. So, if you take that 300-pound blob and you... jackass to a thick-tongued, overbearing, obnoxious, slutty barmaid, what you produce is an offspring called a Dustin. That's right, a Dustin. And a Dustin is a fool that doesn't know how to say the simplest of words. And you know what the simplest of words is? No. No, Daddy! No, Daddy, no! Don't put me in the ring with Terry Funk! Daddy, please! Please, Daddy, don't do it to me, Daddy! I don't want to go! All you have to do is say no! No! No!
Well, geez, I don't think we could possibly top that with anything else I could tack on with the show running short or whatever. So, I'll just leave it at that. Terry Funk is the GOAT, and that'll do it for the PWF, or Florida Championship Wrestling, or whatever they want to call it, from April 30th, 1989.
911, what are you reporting?
This is AC. I have OJ in the car.
Okay, where are you?
Please, I'm coming up the 5 freeway.
Okay.
Right now, we all okay, but you got to tell the police to just back off. He's still alive, and he got a gun to his head.
Is everything else okay?
Everything right now is okay, officer. Everything is okay. All about he wants me to get it to his mom. He wants me to get it to his house.
Okay.
So that's all we ask. He got a gun to his head.
Okay, now what's your name?
My name is AC. You know who I am, goddammit.
Your Uncle Juice is a good man.
Let me just state for the record
that I thought O.J. Simpson was going to blow his brains out on television that night, and that's why I was watching. Although, really, I was watching TV hoping to see the Knicks and the Rockets in Game 5, being a big Hakeem Olajuwon fan. But they even preempted a whole bunch of that in order to show the chase, and then O.J. didn't shoot himself. And quite frankly, it would have saved us a lot of time and trouble and a lot of angst over these last many years. But I guess we wouldn't have a YouTube video of David Schwimmer saying juice over and over again from The People versus O.J. Simpson. So I guess from that perspective, you can kind of talk me into it. There's also my favorite documentary that I've ever seen is one of the ESPN 30 for 30s. It's June 17th, 1994, which was the day of the O.J. chase. And the thing that I love about it so much is that there aren't the talking heads that you'll see in any documentary where they comment on stuff, except humorously, the end song on the documentary is by the talking heads. I don't know if that was a nod to how the documentary was put together, just using clips of everything to kind of give an idea of the chronology of the day and all the stuff that was going on in the world of sports in the United States. You had the New York Rangers Stanley Cup parade, which I would have played a moment for them in 94, but the 94 Rangers are one of the most fraudulent Stanley Cup champions ever because they barely made the playoffs the next year. They didn't make the playoffs the year before that. Also in New York that night, you got the Knicks and the Rockets in the NBA Finals. The World Cup kicked off on that day when it was hosted in the United States in 1994. There was baseball going on all across the country. Ken Griffey Jr. hit his 30th home run, where it looked like he might challenge Roger Maris' home run record, and that would get derailed because of the baseball strike. The U.S. Open golf tournament was also going on, the second round being played that day, and the final round for the legendary Arnold Palmer. So just a whole host of things going on just that one day, and the fact how it was all tied together by Brett Morgan, I think, was just incredibly brilliant. So in other podcasts to listen to, once you're done with this one here on the Sportscasters with Steve Bennett, I'm not sure if he has a show coming out this week, but I did like his sentiments at the end of his last show, where he talked about enjoying things now while they're still there. He's talking about the musician Rick Emmett. But I've often called that in my life the Bob Dylan rules. When I refer to something as operating under Bob Dylan rules, it means you have to go see them now because you may not ever get another chance. You know, given Bob Dylan's advancing age, it was something that I came up with 15 years ago, and I've invoked that a couple of times. Driving to New York to see Pedro Martinez pitch live in 2008, and he did pitch again the following year. That was his last year with the Mets, and in fact, I only think he pitched part of the 09 season. I don't think he was with the Phillies from the start of the year. So something to keep in mind, you know, for professional wrestling or whatever interests you may have. On the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Morano and Michael Quinn taking a look at a WWF Superstars from 1997, either European or Australian edition, because there's no way in hell they would have had Gorilla Monsoon and Raymond Rougeau hosting a show for the United States. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Ring of Honor's own Brian Malonis, they're talking about shirts. T-shirts in wrestling, the best and worst ones. They managed to not mention the Steve Austin Snakes for Arms shirt that I've mocked so mercilessly back in the day. I think that's the point where I turned on Austin slightly, or that t-shirt sucked so much, and just mocking it like, I have snakes for arms, I have snakes for arms. Like, all right, yeah, we get it. I was kind of disappointed that Malonis didn't plug his Bouncers shirt quite as much. I thought he was going to plug it at least three or four times during that one segment. And Brian is actually promoting a show in the state of New Hampshire coming up in March. So more on that a little bit later, as we still got about 4 months until that takes place at the end of March. I certainly hope, the only thing I ask out of that show, and not a lot of wrestling events in New Hampshire, in part because they have those state athletic commission rules, So all I want is an announcement, Joe McHugh style, at the top of the show where they read off the names of the Athletic Commission people. And I think I could sell Brian on this from the point where they'll say promoted by Brian Malonis and then read off all the name all the officials. Maybe you can drag Mike Crockett out of retirement to referee in that one. I think that's a very sound idea. But I'm not done. I have one piece of business left here, and that is another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, these are actual YouTube comments left by presumably actual human beings who are YouTube users about this video in question. And there's a decent number of them, considering that it's PWF from 1989. Not exactly the most high-profile stuff, even though you've heard of most of the people who are actually in this video. KHayes666 says, "Wow, I've never heard of this territory. Good stuff." And yeah, I think anybody who stumbles upon this is probably going to feel similarly to KHayes666. Gay Porn Fluffer says, "Where ECW stole the Funk in the Box angle from, and Funk and Eddie Gilbert had another Texas Chain Massacre match in 1993. Yeah, the box thing had been done even more than the 1991 WCW thing. I just pointed that out because Dusty Rhodes was connected to both, but yes, Terry Funk also connected to both as referenced. Christopher Haas says, "My God, Goldust in 1989. Yeah, people like watching the before times for the guys who were stars in the era in which they watched. That's why WWE Network, a long time ago, put up stuff like Shawn Michaels in Mid-South in the mid-80s, and a whole bunch of other guys, too, because it's kind of almost like new and fresh to a certain audience, especially those of us who were raised in the Northeast and only really had WWF as our territory. Frank Sullivan says, I'm assuming this is not the Red Sox pitcher from the 1950s. Speaking of belts, Humperdinck says that was the Florida heavyweight title on his shoulder, which was held by Al Perez. And if I understand correctly, Dusty held the PWF championship belt. And if memory serves me correctly, Varsity Club Mike Rotundo had the Florida heavyweight championship, which looked like a JCP TV title, but I know FCW had a new Florida belt made right before closure. And Rotundo, God, this is a lot here, gave the belt to Steiner after he won the TV title. They still called it Florida Championship Wrestling. Too confusing." And yes, it was confusing, as I pointed out, and so was this comment. It kind of went in circles there. Jonathan Turbide says, "As much as I love Dusty, in my top 10 all time, this entire PWF promotion was first and foremost a way for him to boost his ego after the whole NWA Crockett's debacle. Still fun to watch." Hey, you know, everybody needs a slump buster, whether you're, you know, talking about Mark Grace with heavy set gals on the road or whatever, or Dusty going in to his old stomping grounds in Florida and having a nice little program with Terry Funk. I don't see the problem with it. Mark Bowman says, "I used to love with the Texas Death matches when they would say, bring anything to the ring but a knife or a gun. LOL, I think Terry Funk was the best storyteller on the mic in the glory days of the sport of professional wrestling. Dusty and Terry from the Bayfront Center, circa 1974, the year I was born. LOL." Well, I can't endorse all the LOLs in here, but pretty much agree with everything else. Borneo Jimmy says, "Shame this Fed didn't last. Not a whole lot of footage out there either. At least not complete episodes. Great stuff. Thanks for sharing." Well, this isn't really a complete episode. It's almost seems like a compilation or whatever. But I'm going to take what I can get. I mean, how else would I be able to cover this little Dusty Rhodes, Terry Funk war of early 1989? And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Now for next week's show, which is the last one before Christmas, and you always want to go home for the holidays in some form or fashion. And for me, going home means revisiting 1991 WWF, because I have not covered stuff from very early in that year. So I figured, why not take a look at a wrestling challenge episode that was loaded for bear Now, February is a sweeps period, and this episode from February 24th has a lot going on, a lot of interesting things, such as a Jim Duggan-Pez Watley match that is being fought for the soul of Greetings from Allentown, I believe. Sergeant Slaughter, General Adnan have some fun with fire at the expense of, well, some Hulk Hogan paraphernalia. The Dream Team explodes. The original Dream, well, the second Dream Team, the new Dream Team of Dino Bravo and Greg Valentine, as those two guys face off with Earthquake at ringside, but we get a visit from, well, the ghost of Dream Team past, I'll just put it that way. And then, of course, the greatness of Gorilla and Bobby and their whole shtick on commentary. And this is one of those shows where Bobby Heenan is pretty hard on Mike McGurk, the ring announcer. So there'll be a lot of fun to be had there. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget to leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music. It does provide what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular podcast. And also, tell a friend if somebody asks, what is a good wrestling podcast to listen to? Of course, you're going to say Greetings from Allentown because it's the right thing to do. I trust that you're going to do that. So thank you in advance for doing that. And do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
I had a jackass. My father walked up to that jackass, cocked a gun, and blew that jackass's brains out.